Hello everyone and welcome to the first boat briefing of a new year, 2021. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and with me, as ever, are Caroline White, Deputy Editor, and Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. I hope you both, and everyone listening, had a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You too. How was yours?
Quiet, as I think most people's were. So those of you not in the UK, just before Christmas, I think it was, we got the news that originally you were allowed to have a kind of a bubble of three families, and it was two families, and it was no families. So it was a solo Christmas for the Campbells, but we had a good time. It was nice to have that time away. How about you guys?
So yeah, for me, pretty much the same. So we had my husband and I had a solo Christmas in our flat. It was pretty much like every other day, but with slightly better food. That was pretty much it for us. How about you, Charlotte?
I mean, I think the most exciting thing I did was discover pigs in blanket crisps. I don't know if they have pigs in blankets in the States, but they're like tiny little sausages wrapped in bacon that you'd have with your Christmas dinner. So those, but crisps. And yeah, that was thrilling. Really enjoyed that, but probably undid any of the lockdown exercise that I was sticking to so diligently pre-Christmas.
You might have to translate crisps for our American listeners as well.
Oh, chips. No? Yeah, chips. Pigs in blanket chips.
So yeah, 2021, it's been slightly spoilt the start of the year, certainly in the UK, by the reimposition of an even stricter lockdown. So we're back in a national lockdown, which means homeschooling for the Campbells, which predictably is going terribly. But it's great to see so many of you guys out there on the water. I've been getting a flurry of pics from people on their boats in places like St. Bart's and some other very beautiful looking Caribbean islands, enjoying the sunshine and the otherworldliness of that place. Lockdowns must feel a very long way away for you guys out on your boats. I must say, it's great to get the photos, but depending on the time of day, these pictures don't always arrive at the right time. Like, for instance, when I'm trying to remember how to do long division with a nine-year-old, I don't think I ever mastered long division. It's like alchemy or some lost science. I just look at a piece of long division, and my brain fuses. I'm sure it's impossible, actually. I don't think anyone knows how to do long division.
I really wouldn't worry about it. I never mastered long division and I'm just totally fine. I'd be interested to know how many kind of, entrepreneur, businessman, yacht owning people say, you know what, I'm successful as I am today because I really nailed the long division back in year six. That's what I attribute my success to.
Yeah, I hope that's true. So there's hope for us yet.
Computers, you can do anything on Excel. Get them on Excel.
Exactly. We've got a fascinating interview lined up for you this week. Caroline, tell us more.
So Mike Horn is a professional adventurer. He's done things like traverse the South American continent solo, circle the equator on foot and by sailing, and too many other amazing things to list, really. He built his 35-meter sailing expedition yacht Pangaea in the favelas of Brazil, and that's been an invaluable tool on his explorations. In 2016, he set off on his pole-to-pole expedition, a two-year circumnavigation of the globe via the South and North Poles. He tells us a bit about that, and he also tells us about the unexpected benefits of exploring during a pandemic last year when he was on his Greenland and Svalbard expedition. He also recounts some amazing personal experiences and gives some fascinating tips, from polar bears to whales and lots about ice. There's also the hair-raising experience last year when an iceberg flipped while he was climbing it, and he plunged into the icy water with an iceberg about to crash down on his head. It was really, he's a fascinating person to listen to if you're planning an expedition, and actually if you're not planning an expedition.
I can't imagine that's a fun sensation, feeling an iceberg tipping under your feet.
No, well, apparently you don't feel it. That's the problem.
Oh, right.
So yeah, he tells it. Yeah, he's really... Yeah, it's incredible. Like the quick thinking, basically, on how to survive. It was all kind of instincts, but it was interesting. And also interesting on the off chance that you're ever in that position to hear about what you should do.
I'm so looking forward to hearing from him. I'm always amazed how calm so many of these adventurers are. They kind of talk about these things like, oh yeah, and then I nearly died because an iceberg nearly fell on my head. And they always just seem incredibly kind of level and relaxed, whereas I'm pretty sure I'd be screaming and jumping up and down and doing all the things you're not supposed to do.
I want to meet a panicky explorer.
I like that idea.
They're all way too cool. It's not right.
No, exactly.
Well, it's actually talking about exploring. our editor-at-large, Roger Lean-Verco, got a great scoop just before Christmas on a new 55-metre explorer yacht in build at Fedship called Shinkai. He spoke to the owner and Philip Briand, the yacht's designer. And I want to mention it because one amazing detail was that the conversation between owner and designer actually started around a submarine yacht. The owner literally had this mind, had in his mind to build a submarine yacht, which I think is incredible. Now, the idea was obviously discarded because I think that's we're not quite there yet in capability terms. But it does speak to the ambition of some of these owners who are, you know, pushing the bounds of yachting all the time, really. And you can head to the website to read that story. It's a really, really good one for a few insights into the building of this incredible boat, which will be with us, I think, in 2022 delivery, or if not later this year. If you can't find it on the website, just go to the search function and enter Shinkai, which is S-H-I-N-K-A-I, and you can get a real insight into this really incredible project. Talking of scoops, 2020 was a year full of them. And this is the last time I do this, I promise. This is the last time I'll test you on the podcast.
I feel like you said that last time.
No. Did I? Maybe I did. Okay. First and last time of 2021. Do you know which news story was the biggest one on our website in 2020? Which got the most traffic in 2020? Any ideas?
So say, is it to do with octopus?
No.
Is it to do with a boat being sold?
No.
It's tough because sometimes they're not the stories you'd think they would be. It could be, for example, a story with really good pictures that's not a big news story, but it just has incredible photos. So unless you have been keeping a very close eye on the quality of the photography, it's quite hard to tell. I imagine there'd have to be something on Nord in there.
No.
Is it to do with a fire?
No, but you're kind of getting a bit warmer. So it's not a great story, actually.
Something to do with my song.
Close. No, not my song. So I'll tell you. I'll put you out of your misery. So the biggest news story was about the collision between the two J-class yachts, Svea and Topaz, during the Superyacht Challenge Antigua in March. And it was this incredible video, frankly, of Svea riding over the stern of Topaz. And actually, unfortunately, three crew members were injured in the accident. And Svea ultimately was found to be at fault for the accident. I think mainly it was the footage that that drove most of the traffic to that story. It is quite an incredible one.
I've clicked on that a few times. It's one of those ones where you think that they're just about going to be fine and then you realise, nope, that's probably happening. Like it's kind of painful to watch, but you can't help replaying it to take a second look at it.
Yeah. And, taking part in a few of these big regattas, you often see these boats, these massive boats tacking in and out of each other and getting very close. And obviously there's the 40-metre rule now. So you've got people on the bow and stern pointing laser pointers at each other. But it's still kind of it speaks to the skill of the guys helming and crewing these boats. There aren't more accidents, frankly, because, huge boats coming pretty, very mm-hmm. close to each other. But yeah, just unfortunately on this one occasion, they got a bit too close. So that was the biggest story of 2020. But on to features. Charlotte, what have you got in store for us?
Well, we've got so many features in the works that I'm excited about this year, going to be popping up at various stages. One is we're doing a big research job to find out what happened to Saddam Hussein's yacht, Basra Breeze. So we've got our best sleuths on the case. But obviously, if you know any amazing secrets about that, then don't hesitate to send them in anonymously. We've got a big design special coming up in May. So a piece I'm really looking forward to is there's an article that our US editor Cecile Gower is writing about what yachts yacht designers themselves own. So I think that should be quite revealing, kind of what makes, what styles they've all got. And there's also going to be a big piece about glass on board. That's something we've seen with a lot of new yachts, these kind of amazing structural glass and clever ways of using it. So that should be a really good read if you're looking to commission a new boat or to make some changes to yours. But a feature that came across my desk just before Christmas, which will also be in that design special, is to do with support vessels. And some of them are just amazing. I mean, they're almost as spectacular, if not more so, than the boats themselves. And there are a few people interviewed for the piece, including Carl Allen, who owns the 50-metre Westport GG and the 55-metre Darman support vessel Axis. Then there was Hans-Jörg Nader, the owner of the 54-metre Baltic Pink Gin and the 46-metre Darman Pink Shadow. And then the writer also takes a look at two other Darman vessels, B3 and Game Changer. But the thing that struck me most from reading the piece is that everyone uses these support vessels differently. So for some people, they always travel together and that makes total sense for them. And they keep all their toys and all their kit on board. And the crew can kind of help each other out when they're moored in the same place and share, you know, all the different tasks between them. For others, separating the vessels means they get to cover a lot more ground. So they have a great time on their boat, then their boat travels somewhere else and they have a great time on their support vessel. Then they fly, then they meet back up with the main boat. So it just means they kind of never have to wait, and they can really enjoy you know, so many different places. And anyway, it was just really interesting to see how different people make the most of them, and I think they're going to become more and more important in an owner's life going forwards. So it's good to see some examples of people who have got really amazing support vessels and are using them to the max.
Well, we know there's a record number in build, so it's not a huge number. There's 6 support vessels in build globally, which is 2 more than in last year's count in the global order book. Darman really have the kind of the corner of that market, although it's not one of their boats that is my favorite support vessel. It's hard to look past Hodor, which is this, I think it's 66 meter cat built in, I think it's in Spain. It's the support to Loney and the Fedship, and it is amazing. It looks amazing, and just the catamaran platform just allows it to carry so much gear, and some of the stuff they've packed onto that support vessel is amazing. I think Echo Yachts in Australia are building one as well. They built another catamaran called Charlie, which is a support to the trimaran White Rabbit, and I think they're building another one as well at the moment, another catamaran, or at least marketing one. So yeah, some really interesting stuff happening on the support vessel front. They are becoming more and more important. And interestingly, you mentioned Carl Allen. So I spoke to Carl last year for our At Home with Boat video series that you can see on our YouTube channel. And the reason he went for the support vessel, he could have bought a much bigger boat, of course, than the 50 meter Westport and 55 meter Darman support vessel. He loves his Westport, didn't want to get rid of that. And it's perfect for the Bahamas and the Exumas, where he does so much cruising. And a bigger boat meant he couldn't get anywhere near the shore. He couldn't drop anchor close to shore, which he loves to do. So he got two kind of 50, 55 meter boats rather than one enormous one. And to him, that makes perfect sense. Mm. And yeah, that's the philosophy a lot of owners are following. Instead of one massive one, have two smaller ones, and it gives you a bit more flexibility.
So that's what I'm working on at the moment. But what's coming up in the news, Caroline?
Well, Safe Harbor Marinas has bought Rybovich Superyacht Marina in the US, which is probably the biggest story I've got for you today. The agreement includes Rybovich's West Palm Beach facility, which accommodates yachts of up to 99 meters, as well as the facility in Riviera Beach. We understand that the superyacht operations at Rybovich will continue to be overseen by the existing team. Royal Houseman, meanwhile, has started construction on its 46-metre high-performance cruiser sloop, Project 405. The owners want to explore the world in a comfortable yacht that's also light enough to make it a serious regatta contender. As a result, the yacht will be built from aluminium and carbon composite. Now to design, penned the yacht inside and out, while Rachel Pugh is responsible for the naval architecture. Ron Dahl will provide the carbon Panamax rig and delivery is scheduled for 2022. Then my third story for you is Tankoa's 50-metre aluminium yacht, Olukon, which has been delivered to its owner. It's the third hull in Tankoa's 50-metre series following Bintador and Vertige, and features a striking black hull and metallic grey superstructure. Designed by Francesco Pascalski, Olukon features a similar layout to her two sister ships, except that she has a main deck, main aft deck wholly dedicated to a large lounging area, and a forward master cabin with a private lounge that can be converted into an extra cabin if needed. Sounds quite useful. So those are the three news stories I've got for you.
Thanks, Caroline. A few yards on a little roll there. We've spoken in the past about how Royal Houseman seem to be in a bit of a purple patch at the moment. They've got some really exciting projects underway, and it's great to see Tankoa too. You know, they seem to be doing really well as well. A fairly new yard, young yard, I should say, but building some really, really interesting boats. And talking about, well, not news, but data, The 2020 year full year brokerage figures are in. So how did the brokerage community fare in 2020, Caroline?
Well, top line, 376 super yacht sales were reported in 2020, and that compares to 406 in 2019 and 436 in 2018, which doesn't seem too bad considering the year that we've had. The average asking price was just over 8 million euros compared to just over 10 million in 2019 and just under 10 million in 2018. It's worth reiterating that we're talking about asking price here, not final sale price. That remains private. It's also worth noting that size plays a very big factor here. There was no official brokerage sale above 100 metres in 2020, while some of these supersized boats were sold in 2018 and 2019. Because of the huge prices that those giant yachts command, they do have the power to hugely influence a year's overall asking prices. So the fact that we didn't have any such sales last year means that we're lacking that big boost. It doesn't necessarily mean that all prices are down significantly. Looking at size in general, the most populated bracket in brokerage was 30 to 40 metres. In fact, at 142 sales, we had three more sales in that range than we did in 2019.
So that's really interesting. I mean, that is kind of the rump of the market, the meat of the market, you should say. I mean, that's where most transactions are done. So for 30 to 40 metre boats, had a really, really strong 2020, which is amazing, really. More sales than 2019.
Exactly. And if you like that, you're going to like the next stat. So the 40 to 50 metre bracket looks even healthier, with 74 sales in 2020 compared to 58 in 2019 and 52 in 2018. So sales in the middle of the market do look very healthy.
It's crazy to think, given the year we had, it's crazy to think that for between 30 and 50 metres, that part of the market was buoyant.
Yeah.
Because 2019 was a bumper year for sales. And so 2020, even better. Wow. Well, good on the brokerage community for shifting so many boats in the 30 to 50 meter bracket. Well done. And it's great to see that the buyers are still out there.
Exactly. So the smallest bracket we record, 24 to 30 meters, was down by 33 sales from 2019 to 135. Also, the largest end of the scale was also quieter, with 19 sales in the 50 to 70 metre category compared to 32 in 2019 and 34 the year before. In the 70 metre plus category, we only had 6 sales compared to 9 in 2019 and 13 in 2018.
So that's quite a big hit, isn't it, to those bigger brackets. So 50, 70 metres down from 32 to 19. That's a big old drop, isn't it, in that market? Yeah. So bigger buyers, a bit quieter, evidently, in 2020.
Exactly. I mean, it's also worth noting that, as indicated earlier, the plus bit of the 70 metre plus section can hide some real disparities from year to year. So, for example, the biggest yacht sold in 2018 was the 115 metre project that's been known as Project Enzo and Testarossa at various points, which will be launched this year. In 2019, it was 125 metre Project Jag. And last year, the biggest was 77 metre Project Blue Marlin at Admiral. So that's 115 metres, 125 metres, then in 2020, 77 metres. So you can see why it makes a big difference to things like asking price, whether you've got those absolutely super, super sized yachts in the running.
It sometimes makes forecasting and analysis of the bigger market quite tricky too, because a couple of sales here and there make massive difference to the figures.
Well, aside from extremely large boats, given the year that we've had, it looks like brokers have done a really remarkable job in keeping a level market in 2020 with a very strong core in the midsize of super yachts.
Yeah, bravo. Bravo to all the brokers out there. Well done.
Yeah, really is quite an impressive achievement, I think.
Yeah, I'm blown away by those 30 to 50 meter figures. Yeah, great work. Right. Thank you for that, Caroline. Some fascinating insights as ever. I look forward to next week's data. What have you got? Have you got an idea yet?
We're going to do, I think, another 2020 review, but we'll do something different. Perhaps builders. We'll see. Keep it secret for now.
I look forward to it. Righty. On to your interview with Mike Horn. So I just want to make a note that when Mike in this interview talks about this year, He really means last year, because this interview was recorded towards the end of 2020. So just make a note that when he's talking about this year, he's referring to 2020 and not 2021. I hope that's clear. Right, and without further ado, here is Caroline's interview with adventurer Mike Horn.
Mike Horn, it's a pleasure to have you with us on the Boat Briefing podcast.
We're always speaking to people that's interested in boats, especially now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, people are very interested in, particularly if they can't get on their boats, I'm sure they're even more interested to hear from people who have been on boats. So to start off with, could you tell us about your 35-metre expedition sailing yacht, Pangaea, and why you decided to build her?
I love the ocean and I like going to places that aeroplanes don't go to. I like the remote and untouched places of the earth. And I've been a professional explorer for 30 years. So I needed to build a vessel that could be could take me to any place in the world. And that's when I had the idea of building this like a SUV, the four-wheel drive of the ocean, to be able to have a shallow draft, to sail up the Amazon River, to sail over coral, and then as well to be able to build the hull strong enough that I can go into the ice. And that allowed me to build a quite a light but structurally very strong 105-foot sailing vessel with a ketch rigging. And at that stage, when I started looking at this project, I had to kind of get a lot of partners together. So the aluminum or the aluminium I found in Brazil, and I went to a company called Alcoa, and Alcoa basically gave me the aluminium without me paying for it. And that is how the project started. And they said, well, if you're not going to pay for the aluminium, you're building our boat. So that's basically how the project got financed in the beginning. I didn't have any money. I had an idea. The boat was designed by a Brazilian, Belgium architect and engineer. And I had the plans. All I needed to do is build the boat and then found, like I said, the aluminium in Brazil and built the boat in the favelas of São Paulo, in the slums of São Paulo, simply because I wanted a project where people could walk to work, where people didn't have employment and we could employ people with a trade. Like welders, electricians, carpenters, plumbers, hydraulic specialists. In Brazil, especially in São Paulo, we have 19 million people or 20 million people. There's a lot of guys out there with amazing skills that cannot find work. So we kind of rounded them up and started this project where everybody walked to work, where I started a little bit nursery school, where I had a little football team, and everybody worked for nothing, just for food in the beginning, until I built the hull. And when I built the hull, that was basically when I went back to Europe, and Mercedes-Benz was a sponsor of mine since 2001. And I went to my partners, which was, Mercedes-Benz on one hand, the Richemont Group, it's a watch company called Panerai on the other. And I said, well, I'm building this boat. There's the photos of the boat. Are you going to help me? And that is when both of the sponsors said, yes, we'll support this project because it sounds so amazing. The idea was to build a boat to take young people around the world to go and show them the beauty of the planet and then teach them through science how to conserve these natural, intact beauty that our planet still have. and then do projects where we could see the human influence in it. So I took them to the Amazon, showed them the most amazing jungle, but then moved back a little bit and showed them how the human destroyed the jungle, how they cut the trees, how they burned the forest. And they had two reference points. And then they said, wow, we've got to do something. And the project that was called Pangaea or Pangaea was then the name of the boat. So 11 months later, Pangaea was built, was put into the ocean. I sailed across the Atlantic Ocean without doing one day of sea trials and took it to Monaco, where Prince Albert of Monaco baptized the boat with a friend of mine, Gaynor Rupert, that was a South African, friends of mine that owns the Richemont Group, you know, Cartier, Montblanc, Panerai, all these, the luxury good brands that eventually baptized the boat. And then I started this 5-year trip around the world with young people.
Amazing. That sounds fantastic. So turning to this year, I understand that from July to September, you were on an expedition to Greenland and Svalbard on the yacht. Could you tell us about that trip and whether COVID affected it, if it did affect it?
You know, last year, this time I did that first ever winter crossing of the North Pole with Borgi Ausland. So Pangaea, the Pangaea project with the young explorers came to an end. Because I said, I'll do it for 5 years where I give my time to the young people and we'll take them to these places, educate them, and then let them out in the world to be able to do their projects. So after the 5 years was done, I sailed into Monaco and the project was ended. And that's when I said, now I need to go on another expedition called Pole to Pole. And the Pole to Pole expedition was the circumnavigation of the world, sailing down again from Monaco with my boat to Antarctica. Pangaea would drop me off on one side of the continent. I would solo ski across the Antarctic continent that was never done before, while my boat sails around the world and picks me up on the other side. Then I get back onto the boat, sail to the North Pole, as far as I can into the pack ice, get off the boat, then walk across the North Pole, and the boat will sail through the Northeast Passage above Russia to pick me up on the other side. So that was the plan. Last year, exactly this time, I was on the North Pole or on the Arctic Ocean when I tried to do the first crossing of the North Pole with a friend of mine, Borgi Ausland. So Pangaea dropped me off at 85 degrees, 30 minutes north. And that's the highest that any privately owned sail yacht could sail into the polar ocean and out without drifting across, without being frozen into the ice. So there's two methods of crossing the polar ocean. You sail in, you wait for winter to come, your boat freezes, and then you drift across with the Transarctic drift towards Greenland. So you go up north of Russia or through the Bering Strait. And then if you're lucky, 2 years later, you'll get to the other side. We couldn't afford to wait for 2 years. So the boat had to drop me off in the end of summer, beginning of winter. Then the sun sets and it becomes dark. And it becomes dark for 4 months on the polar ocean. And that's when everything freezes. And that's when I crossed the polar ocean in 24-hour darkness. I didn't see much. For more than 100 days, I didn't see a polar bear. And in 2006, when Borgi Ausland and myself did the first ever winter expedition from Russia to the North Pole, we saw polar bears every third or fourth day. There's even a polar bear that came into the tent. There's a polar bear that sat on the tent on top of my stomach with me inside the sleeping bag. And they are a big problem for us and our security and our lives. Because when the polar bear decides to attack you, you can't do much to defend yourself. The polar bear can smell 50 kilometers. So he can smell you 50 kilometers away. You can't even, you don't even know he's there, but he knows you there. A polar bear can walk 80 kilometers a day. So he can walk further than what he can smell. So he can get to you in under 24 hours. And then a polar bear can swim 100 kilometers. So a human being is so low on the food chain and the polar bear is so high that the polar bear decides what he wants to do with you. We can't really defend ourselves against the polar bear. We've got a flare gun that we can shoot at it. And hopefully the flare frightens the polar bear and he runs away. Otherwise, we can't kill a polar bear because guns don't really work at those temperatures. And it becomes very difficult. So we're very focused on what's happening with the polar bear movement, because the moment you get into the tent, you can't really see them. They can smell you. And if they come and eat you inside the tent, that's a little bit sad for my daughters. But anyhow, I won't make it. So what happened was in 100 days, we didn't see polar bears. And that showed me that there was a big change on the Arctic Ocean since 2006 when we went, and that was only in 14 years. In 14 years, when I reached the North Pole in 2006, the ice was on the North Pole about 2.5 meters thick. This year, or last year, this time when I crossed the North Pole, I was walking on ice between 5 to 8 centimeters. So why didn't we see any polar bears? Because the ice has become very thin. The ice has been broken up and drifting apart. There's a lot of open water between the ice floes. And the polar bear needs a solid ice to hunt. He needs a seal to come sit on top of the ice, and then he can attack the seal. But if there's too much open water around, the seal is too far from the ice for the polar bear to get to him. So the polar bears go to the continent. They go to Siberia, Canada, and Alaska. They go off the polar ocean. And they go and eat people and dogs of the Eskimos, the Inuits, the Nyanse, the Dalgana, all the northern Eskimo Inuit tribes that you find above the Arctic Circle. So that's why they get killed as well, because nobody wants to be eaten by a polar bear, so the locals kill them. The female polar bear, for example, she to protect her cubs, because the male polar bear kills the cubs so that the female can go on heat again and he can mate with her.
Goodness.
So that's what I've experienced during the crossing. Why did I go back? Because I wanted to see life again. I was in complete darkness for over 130 days on the polar ocean, doing what no other man on earth has ever done. And I didn't have hope for the polar ocean. I wanted to see life again. I wanted to see what I knew in 2006. And that's when I said that I will sail up to the polar ocean, first of all, because of the COVID that started. The COVID kept all the boats, the governmental boats, in port. And no weather buoys were dropped off in the polar ocean. And these weather buoys, we all need to be able to calculate the weather. There would have been a big gap. I said, I'll go and drop them off. I'm going up there. You guys put the weather buoys. You tell me where you want them to drop off. And as we go, we'll drop them off. So we had a mission. At the same time, COVID shut down all the hunting of the whales. And that allowed me to be able to go into the polar ocean and then record whale songs. A whale that's hunted is stressed. And you can, through whale songs, you can record a stressed whale. And when there's no hunting, a whale that just swims freely.
How interesting.
To compare these data was the only time in the history of our planet now during the COVID and the lockdown that it gave us an opportunity to do it. Never before did human beings shut down like we did now. So Then as well, what we try to do is to record, fly with drones over the whales, and when they breathe, we capture the spray, and then it can be analyzed to be able to see the microplastics, the infections, and all these things that is happening with the whales in the ocean that's busy changing today. So that gave me more enough reason to be able to go and sail up into the Arctic. First of all, because I wanted to go. And no better place to confine yourself than on a boat where you have nobody. Second of all, be able to create to get unique data that we couldn't have before. And third of all, to give myself a little bit of hope for the future of our planet.
Fantastic. So I understand that on that trip, there's quite a famous video of you climbing an iceberg and the iceberg flipping while you're trying to climb it. Can you tell me about that experience?
You know, I've been climbing. I've been a professional explorer for 30 years, and I climbing some of the highest mountains, and always out there on the polar ocean, falling into the water, knowing that the risk that I take can cost me my life. So I'm not somebody that do what I do to die. I'm somebody that do what I do because that's what makes me feel alive. That's what, makes me want to wake up in the morning. So I was looking at this iceberg from far away, and it was one piece of ice in the ocean. And it was such a beautiful pyramid and stuff like that, that I said to this friend of mine, Fred Rue, that he's my climbing partner and an adventurer as well, let's stop and climb this iceberg. And knowing very well that they do turn, icebergs even sail up against the current, because an iceberg is like a sail. And if the wind catches the iceberg at the right angle, it sails like a boat because it's got a keel, it's deep in the water, and the iceberg moves. So it doesn't always go with the currents. And we know that when it melts at the bottom and it becomes top heavy, the iceberg flips around. That we know. And what we always hope not to happen is we hope that the iceberg doesn't turn. It wasn't that it was the complete wrong thing to do, but we usually climb icebergs that's grounded. So the bottom of the icebergs runs aground a little bit in shallow water, and then you can climb them and we know they won't flip. But this was the only iceberg in the surrounding that was so beautiful, and we kind of made the mistake of saying, okay, we're going to do it and hope that it doesn't happen. So there was a couple of factors that happened. So the boat approaches the iceberg. The iceberg is moving in this way. Our boat's moving in this way. We put pressure on the iceberg so we can get off the boat onto the iceberg. It's not so much our weight that's going to change anything, but sometimes a little bit of weight more or less is going to create the tipping point. It's like that drop that makes the glass overflow. So the boat's pushing the iceberg. The iceberg wants to move this way, and the boat's pushing it this way. So it's stable. The boat reverses, and with the prop wash, the engines pushing the water back, pushes the bottom of the iceberg. When the top wants to move that way, the bottom moves this way, and we at the bottom and the iceberg turns.
Wow. So you're flipped into these freezing waters. What was going through your mind when that was happening?
You know, you don't usually survive when icebergs fall on you. And when Fred, the guy that was with me, his son called out to me, because at the bottom of the iceberg, you don't really feel that it's moving, because that's close to the pivot point. So you don't have that feeling. The iceberg's floating and you feel a little bit that it's not on stable, but you don't feel that it's actually flipping until you see, wow, now I'm going backwards and I should be going forward. That's The first thing that I said was, stay close to the ice. Fred thought he could quickly climb up and over the iceberg to be on the other side of the iceberg. So, and then he'll be okay. But it turned so quickly that you can't do much. Because I was in the middle when the iceberg flipped, I thought, okay, if I fall into the water, I'll go into the water a little bit. And because my clothing's full of air, you know, I've got a down jacket, it's full of air. The heat that my body creates will heats up my clothing, and there's air trapped in my clothing. I'm going to fall into the water and straight away come out. And if I fall into the water and I come out and the iceberg comes down at that stage, I'm going to be crushed. So first of all, I thought, okay, if you stick your arms out and you've got your two ice axes and the ice falls on top of the ice axe and you get pushed into the water, you're not going to have that effect of being crushed. But this happens in like milliseconds in your head. Okay, stick your arms out. You know, don't try and go deep. While Fred tried to climb over, he was then ejected to the side. But I was in the middle. I couldn't get away. So I was pushed underneath the ocean. I felt the ice on my ice axis, pushed down a little bit, and then pushed the ice axis to the side to try and get onto the other side. And when the water displaced, I got luckily pushed onto the other side. And when I stuck out my head just on the side of the iceberg, because you have your eyes open and the water is quite clear, you can see the ice just darkening. Everything becomes dark above your head. I said, shit, yeah, it's done. And then just managed to see the light and the iceberg came close to me and I'm alive. The most stupidest thing I've ever done in my whole life. Now you're in the Arctic Ocean. Crampons, ice axes, climbing boots, clothing, no life jacket, and the clothes sucks up all the water. It's not waterproof clothing, and you get pulled down to the bottom of the ocean.
Oh.
So prior to us leaving, just to prepare, I knew that the iceberg we know it can turn. I told Jacek, the engineer, to get our little tender ready and to be ready in case we make a mistake and we fall into the Arctic Ocean or if the iceberg would turn to be close by. But because it happened so quickly, they were still moving back and kind of standing there looking at us climbing. In fact, well, nobody was on the tender. And when the iceberg turned, the boat was still moving back. They couldn't get a rope to us. And that's when Jacek, the engineer, jumped into the tender and started the engine and then came to us while we were fighting to keep our head above the water. The water's cold. It's like -1 degree. Because freezing water, salt water freezes at -2 or -3. First of all, you're nice and warm, and then really you feel the cold. But through some breathing exercises and being exposed to extreme cold weather for long periods of my life, through breathing I can heat my body, and you've got to stay calm. So to activate certain parts of your brain that allows you to drive the oxygen and blood to the extremities and the vital organs is a method that we as explorers use quite often, especially on polar exploration. When I crossed Antarctica solo 2 years ago or 3 years ago, temperatures went down to -60 degrees Celsius. So the water at -2 is quite warm in comparison with -60, but you're sinking. Then the boat came. Fred, that's more a mountaineer than a swimmer or somebody that does polar exploration. I helped him onto the boat and the crew pulled him on the boat. Then we got into the into the tender, got to the boat, ripped off the clothing, and then you've got to reheat the body. But you can't jump into a hot shower because you don't feel anything. You've got to be able to slowly reheat the body to 37 degrees Celsius. And there's different methods of doing that. So get underneath a space blanket with a candle, slowly heating the body, breathing, moving, getting blood circulation going again. And then slowly but surely start with a colder shower that you will increase the temperature of the water to body temperature. And that is what we did. And then about an hour later, we were okay.
Incredible. Okay. Well, while we're on the theme of ice, could you tell us about some of the different types of ice that you've encountered on your expeditions in the boat rather than in the water, and perhaps what not to do when you come across ice and what to do when you come across ice?
Yeah, when you're on a boat, it's very important to understand basically the season that you find up. In the winter, when it's cold, the ice becomes rock hard. That ice can easily break as well, because it's hard. And if you, the moment you've got a boat going up and hitting it, it cracks. If you take that same thickness of ice at the end of summer, where it's all soaked up, where the ice becomes soggy, you can see there's even water on top of the ice a little bit. You try and get onto that with the same boat, the same thickness, you ride up onto the ice, and the moment that the boat falls onto the ice, the ice gives way but doesn't crack. So it creates slush. And slush sucks the boat in, while colder ice breaks up in small bits and drifts away. So the boat, once sucked into slush ice, starts sucking up slush into the inlets, the water inlets into the boat. And if you have an engine cooled by ocean water, then you're sucking ice into slush in the cooling system. That blocks some of the filters, and then your engines would start overheating. So Pangaea is a boat that's got a keel cooling system. So we don't suck up the water from the ocean and the slush. And we circulate the water through a closed cooling system that's got 1,200 liters of glycol, antifreeze. So we constantly, as we sail over, the water cools the antifreeze as it runs through the engines and just circulates like that. The difference between sea ice and river ice, freshwater ice, is quite visual. Where sea ice would be a little bit blue, you can see the darker the ice becomes, it shades from gray to blue, and gray would be younger ice. That would be where, if you have a boat that's not an icebreaker, Pangaea is not an ice-breaking vessel. It's an ice-going vessel. So it's not ice-classed. But the difference between an ice-classed vessel that, it doesn't matter what's in front of it, if you take a nuclear ice, a Russian icebreaker, it just breaks through the ice, any ice. But for amateurs like us that have only a 105-foot ice-going vessel, we've got to carefully choose the ice that we're going to break. As soon as you see pack ice, for example, and this is another different ice, pack ice, you see it's two ice sheets that would hit each other and then break up, and you could see one bit of ice on top of another bit of ice. That's areas that you have to avoid as well, because it means is the ice sheets go one underneath each other, and the ice would be much thicker in those parts than where you have only flat bits of ice. Then you've got to see ice that's been in collision with each other. Don't look for a piece of ice that's nice and big and flat, but look at pieces of ice that's collided with each other, because the collision creates cracks. And that is when you can put the nose of your boat into these cracks and push the ice apart by gently applying power to the boat. These methods are because I sailed in the northern latitudes and in the southern latitudes for most of my life, is experience that you need. Any captain can't just go in there and think he can sail in the polar ocean. The chances of damaging the boat and making holes through, especially steel boats, because steel tears. Aluminium, my boat's made out of aluminium, much lighter, not as resistant as steel. But when I have a massive impact, my boat just changes shape. The aluminium bends while steel tears. And when the steel tears, you have an influx of water.
Thank you. Very, very useful advice. So I understand that you tried to have a guy up the mast at all times while you're navigating.
The whole time you need to be able to have, because we get the ice charts. We get the ice charts, and the ice chart gives us information, but it's delayed information. It's not at the moment present. So the first thing we do is we take the ice chart, we look at the time, the local time, and the time that the photo was taken from the satellite. Then we calculate the drift. Where will that piece of ice be where we are now? Because if there's 3 hours of difference or 2 hours of difference and the drift is 2 knots, that's 6 miles. You've got to reposition the ice on your chart that you do manually. Then we put somebody on the mast that describes us what he sees, and we compare it with the ice chart and the chart that we set up with the drift calculated in it. Mm. And that gives us a good idea to know if we're in position or not. And then the guy on top of the mast is constantly speaking to the captain or to the guy that's steering the boat to show him the best way possible. Now, for somebody that's got no experience on the ice, to be able to know where there's open water and where there's ice far ahead of you is not easy. So you've got to look at the clouds. So if you have a lot of ice, white ice in front of you, the light reflects onto the sea ice into the air, and there will be white clouds above you on the horizon. The moment that white cloud turns into a gray cloud, means that the light that comes no longer reflects from the ice, but reflects from the water. And that darker color will then reflect as a mirror in the sky. And you will see darker patches ahead of you instead of lighter patches. And that's what the guy on the mast is looking for.
How interesting. Thank you. So I'm aware that we're running out of time. So I'm just going to ask you one more question, which is, if a sailing superyacht owner was planning an expedition to Antarctica for the first time, assuming he had a capable boat, what advice would you give him?
No, I think to be able to take somebody that knows the ice is going to make his life so much easier. To be able to not put yourself into a situation, not to put yourself into a dangerous situation, needs a little bit of foresight, and to be conservative, especially in the polar ocean and in Antarctica, is of the utmost importance. To be able to use icebergs as shelter, because I built a boat with a shallow draft. So if I see ice is coming towards me and the wind's coming and I can't get out, and that ice is going to crush me on the land and onto the rocks and stuff like that, I built my boat with a shallow enough draft that the icebergs will run aground before I run aground, because the icebergs they have 9/10 is below water and 1/10 is above water. So I sail close to them, they run aground, and then I shelter behind them, the biggest icebergs. Those little things, you know, all captains should know before you go into Antarctica. If you want to go into Antarctica, first of all, please respect the environment. We don't want 100,000 super yachts. If you guys can, you know, if people can kind of do stuff together instead of individually, that would allow us as well not to overflock these most amazing, beautiful places, but to really appreciate them by being together in a boat. There is boats that you can charter out there that is more adapted with a crew that's better knowledge. And I know we want to always take our own boat to these places. Take your boat to South Georgia and then get onto a boat that will allow you to enjoy what's happening and not be stressed with the risk of losing your boat and losing the life of people. So never, you can build a Titanic, the strongest boat in the world, but the ice is always stronger than you. And that is something you must never forget. Doesn't matter how much money you have, your life becomes very short when you're in trouble there. Doesn't matter how much money you have, nobody can get to you. So respect nature and nature will respect you.
Well, thanks, Mike. That sounds like a good note to end on. Really appreciate your time, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of Boat Briefing. It was mixed and produced by Ed Cavendish and was a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Have a great one, and we'll see you next time.